It's Light the Tower, your daily look around the world of sports with Hall of Fame broadcaster and voice of the Texas Longhorns, Craig Way.
Say goodnight to this one!
And Horns 24-7 insider, Jeff Howe. On your live, local, and independent home for sports talk in Austin, The Horn.
Second hour of Light the Tower on the Horn. Craig Way, Jeff Howe with you. Clean up from hour number one. And that includes, as a follow-up to my story about my grandson Gideon, who turned three today, who loves the trash collectors. Goes out front, waves to him every day. They wave back. They honk to him every day. Loves it. Just absolutely. And he got a big trash truck as a Christmas gift. You know, so he really likes the trash collector. Somebody said that my son was obsessed with the trash man, and he missed them one Monday. So my mother-in-law drove around till I found him and followed him for several minutes. The driver actually called the police to report someone following him around. Yeah, a 65-year-old woman, a 40-year-old were stalking him. So that's because there was that fascination with the trash collector. They loved the trash truck and all of that stuff. In talking about stadium, somebody said it wasn't exactly state of the art, but I love Rice Stadium in Houston. It's a good place to see a football game. The only thing I didn't like about it is in the upper deck part where the bleacher seats had not been swapped out. They're wooden. I got splinters. Actually got splinters. Out of sitting there one time. You had to be careful there. It's also very tight broadcast booths there. But I enjoyed calling games there. I enjoyed that. So talking about San Diego and Qualcomm, CB says Texas with Mac went 5 holiday bowls, played at the Rose Bowl 3 times. California was Texas' second home for the bowls. Was for a while. It was. Somebody mentioned Jay Wright started getting McDonald's guys. Then he missed the NCAA. Then he'd be back to building with Nova guys and won 2 natties. To your point about
yeah. There's a difference between collecting talent and building a team.
And somebody else pointing out fried crickets is a little bit of a delicacy, I guess.
There's some cricket. I've had some kind of cricket.
Have you had the chocolate covered grasshoppers before?
That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember how they tasted or anything like that, but I know I've had those before.
Right. Somebody else, my 3-year-old.
Not something I actively seek out, Craig.
I understand. Somebody else, my 3-year-old loves garbage trucks and smoke detectors. You know? So, yeah, there's that. Anyway, somebody said, not sure if you talked about this yet, but since Schlossnagel moved to Texas A&M, do you think Tadlock might move to TCU, even though he signed the contract? The answer is that no, I don't think so.
Yeah, we can talk about that for a quick sec, and we'll get into it more tomorrow when Kendall Rogers is on with us in this time slot.
One other thing, and we'll get at somebody said, I have a lawn customer in Pflugerville whose sons, 2 sons, aged 18 months and 3 years, will watch me mow their backyard. They keep watching until I'm completely done with everything. There's that fascination with that, yeah. So there you are with that. All right, so that was the catch-up there, as we always like to do right out of the gate. CB letting us know that he had fried alligator at the Texas Renaissance Festival in high school. Tasted like chicken.
Of course. The Jim Schlossnagel to Texas A&M news. Greg,
yep.
This is something you and I have talked about this, gosh, it seems like ever since before the Rob Childress news officially became official.
It'd been a rumor for a while.
Yeah, and so it didn't catch me by surprise that it actually happened. It is interesting, though, that I think if any major college baseball program, in theory, is in a good, if you can call it a good position to lose a head coach, it probably is TCU, because the logical choice now is Kirk Arnold is just going to go from pitching coach to head coach. I think that would be
That's what I think everyone is expecting to happen.
So
TCU will probably do their quote-unquote national search, but I think Kirk Arnold will be the odds-on favorite.
It seems like it's going to be a move that's going to work out for everybody. Kirk Arnold will get he'll get the TCU job, which he's been in a position to be a Power 5 head coach for a number of years now. And Jim Schlossnagel goes and takes the Texas A&M job, a job that I think he can do well in. He knows this state, obviously, knows the kind of talent you can get at Texas A&M. And they needed a Ross Bjork, they really needed to make a splash hire. If you're going to move on from Rob Childress, you got to go get you a coach that can take you over the hump. Now, we know Rob Childress got them to Omaha, but now I think for Texas A&M fans, I think winning in Omaha now becomes that hump you got to get over, and Schloss has done that.
Yeah. It never had him in a national championship series, but got him to the semifinals and four straight trips to Omaha as well. So so that's the imminent news that'll come down. Kendall Rogers, D1Baseball.com, reported it first about 1 o'clock this morning, something like it was late last night, that kind of thing. And he will join us tomorrow morning on the program to discuss not only that, but also preview all the super regionals. That'll be going on. So
now, real quick, before I get to our fun fact of the day, as we sit here, 87 days until kickoff. What's your gut tell you, Craig, on what happens to that Rice job? You know, Matt Braga got let go a couple of weeks ago. We know Sean Allen, the Texas pitching coach, is interviewed for that job.
Well, I would have said Lance Berkman until he took the Houston Baptist job.
Right. It seems Sean Allen seems to fit the kind of profile for what I think that Rice job needs right now in terms of a head coach. I think if you're a coaching candidate for that job, you've got to ask some really hard questions of that administration.
Absolutely. You got to know how much is the commitment. You say, well, what do you mean the commitment? They had this great program. They won a national title in 03. They were a regular in regional, super regionals, and for a few brief years, they were regular in Omaha. Very easily could have been in the national championship series in 06, but North Carolina knocked them out, and they're in Omaha, could have been in that national series. But the program has fallen off, and some of that, it's been said, is because of some of it's because of the way that it has to be built academically at Rice, but also there's a thing with regard to the financial commitment to the program. I mean, they got a great ballpark, but there's other things apparently lacking from that. Yeah, so
infrastructure. It's a big thing at Rice right now.
Yep. So I think those questions will probably be asked by any prospective future head coach.
Yeah. You want to get to our fun fact of the day, Craig?
Please do.
And I'm going to use this to kind of pontificate a little bit, so just take this ride with me. 87 days away from kickoff, so it's as good a day as any to remind folks that, Kyle Shanahan did play football at Texas, and, he had some injury issues. What was the weird deal before his first year, Craig? Like, he cut his heel trying to jump over a fence.
I think that was
required
right.
Some surgery or something. It was kind of a weird deal. But he finished through the 01 and the 02 seasons, 14 catches for 127 yards. Yeah, it was kind of hard to find reps in the receiver room at Texas at that time when you're behind Roy Williams and Sloan Thomas. And had he not had his own injury issues, BJ Johnson would have been drafted and probably would have gotten to stick around in the NFL a little bit longer. So only one football to go around at Texas at the time. And that was the time,
Most gave a tight end.
Yeah, when Texas had tight ends who were like legitimate dudes at tight end. Most gave it a young David Thomas. So Kyle Shanahan did have a career at Texas. He is a head coach and a successful head coach in the NFL. He's taken the San Francisco 49ers to the Super Bowl. He was the offensive coordinator for the Atlanta Falcons when they blew that 28-3 lead in the Super Bowl. But I mentioned Kyle Shanahan, Craig, because it got me thinking about pro football, and I just want to bring this topic up. When you look at Longhorns in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I still, even though you've got the Hall of Fame now in the North End Zone, I still don't think enough is made in this program to prop up guys that are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Now, one guy, and I think by proxy another guy, one guy's got his name on the field now. Earl Campbell has his name on the field. So I don't think Texas fans have trouble identifying with Earl Campbell. But I do think there's a notch down. I think in the minds of some Texas fans, there's certainly generations now Texas fans that I don't think have a grasp of Bobby Lane and what he meant to the game of football and his impact on it when he was with the Detroit Lions, and he's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I'm still amazed, Craig, that you have Longhorn fans kind of go, oh, yeah, or wow, I didn't know that. When you mention, now, there are four, as of this August, there are going to be four Longhorn Lettermen all-time who are going to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Bobby Dillon got voted in last year, but they had to bump the ceremony back, so he will be inducted with that monster class that's going to go into Canton this summer. I think they're doing it over 4 days, Craig. I think I read that right. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a four-day deal. But Tom Landry's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Tom Landry is a letterman at the University of Texas, was a letterman at the University of Texas. A member of DBU is Tom Landry. And I still don't think enough is made out of the fact that Tom freaking Landry is a product of the football program at the University of Texas. Now, Tex Schramm also in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, a Texas graduate, not a Texas letterman. But I think,
that's right, he wasn't in the athletic department. He was a journalism student.
I think those five guys, Craig, and specifically Tom Landry, when you're making a short list of the greatest coaches that have ever coached this game of football, he's on the short list. And I just don't think enough is made. I don't know if there's an issue with the Landry family in Texas. I have no idea. There could be some backstory that I just don't know about that I'm oblivious
to. Do you want to know the backstory?
Sure.
I'll tell you the backstory.
Sure.
And it's a very innocuous backstory.
Why I'm bringing this up right now.
The reason why I say this is what I learned about it was from the historian of all historians at University of Texas Athletics, Bill Little.
Right.
And what he told me was because for a long time folks would say, you know, why is it Tom Landry's name is never mentioned, blah, 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 and then it went on and on and on and on and on. Even though he's in the Hall of Honor.
He is.
And went in like 1970 or 71. I mean, he was pretty early. That it had to do with, there wasn't an ill will toward him, but he was never down here for games as a letterman or anything like that because he was busy.
Yeah,
he was busy.
He was a little preoccupied.
He was coaching a team, and everybody understood it. Everybody got there was no undercurrent or ill will or bad blood, but it made it easier to be out of sight, out of mind on things like that.
Okay,
for people, it wasn't a bad thing or anything like that. But he could like never come down for the Hall of Honor ceremonies on a weekend. He couldn't be present for any of that or for other things, and so he just wasn't around. That was the reasoning behind it. Because I asked Bill, I used to ask him, about, and he finally explained it, what he was able to find out. Because he had to ask the questions.
Okay. If Bill Little had to ask the question, then I don't feel bad about not knowing if there was any backstory.
No. He had to ask the questions from people in the know back in the day. And the answer he got was, no, we had nothing against him. And Tom had nothing against us. It was all good. It's just he was living his life. He was busy being the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys and couldn't make it down for any games or anything because on Saturdays it's a preparation before they had a Sunday game. It was really as simple as that. And I remember talking about this a little more before Texas played Nebraska in the 2009 Big 12 football championship game because of the Tom Landry statue that is out front of AT&T Stadium.
Right.
And Bill had never done a Longhorn legend on Tom Landry. And he had never had. And we'd had the Longhorn Legend features. He had never done one. And he'd done one on somebody. And I'd finally asked him, and he told me that he was saving or preparing to do or whatever, and he did a beautiful piece on him for 2009.
Okay.
And but he also, before he did it, wanted to make sure to turn over every stone and make sure there was no ill will or hard issues or things he didn't know. And asked the people who needed to be asked about it, and they said no. And you know, we love Coach, but you know, he hadn't been here, and you know, just kind of out of sight, out of mind. He's been that as much as anything. He wasn't able to commit to come down for anything.
I know Chris Del Conte has made it a point to make Tom Landry a more prominent figure with the physical, mm-hmm. you know, Hall of Fame now and things of that nature. And I'm, you know, Craig, it's one of those deals that if you put a display up in Moncrief, recruits probably aren't going to care. They'll walk by it or whatever. But for me personally, as a Dallas Cowboys fan, as somebody who's followed this Texas program for a long time, as somebody who loves football in this state, the fact that you can tie Tom Landry to the University of Texas, I would just like to see more done with it.
I understand. That's, somebody had pointed out, I don't know why the coaching, Mexican Elvis said, I don't know why the coaching tandem of Tom and Vince at the New York Giants is so overlooked. Can you imagine Landry and Lombardi coaching together and Tom was a player coach? I've read an awful lot about the history of that, including the preeminent biography on Vince Lombardi called When Pride Still Matters that David Marinus wrote. Incredible. And there's a great sideline photo of the 1956 season when they won the NFL championship where you see Jim Lee Howell, the coach of the Giants. The offensive coordinator was Vince Lombardi and the defensive coordinator was Tom Landry. And Landry had played for the Giants into the early 50s and was kind of a player coach, as Mexican Elvis said. By the time they got to 56, he was just full-time coach. He was on the sidelines and and coat and tie and that sort of thing. And they got along, they liked each other, but they were two completely different types, as we know. And then Lombardi was left after the 58 season, as did Landry, to get ready to coach with the startup of the Cowboys. And Lombardi was supposed to be the heir apparent to Jim Lee Howell with the Giants, but they couldn't promise him that. Mm. When the Packers were ready to offer him whatever it took, the coach and the GM in 1959. And he had another conversation with Tim Mara, the owner of the Giants, and said, where are we with this? And they said, well, you know, coach is still with us, so, you know, and they couldn't promise anything. So we left. And then they tried to bring him back. They tried it when Jim Lee Howell stepped down, but by then Lombardi was entrenched with the Packers, and that was that. So that's where some of the statements about that. And toward that end on the NFL front, somebody said the last time the Lions were relevant and won a championship was with Bobby Lane, 1957. But Lane wasn't even the main quarterback of the Lions that year. He was in 52 and 53 when they won their back-to-backs, but he'd been injured a lot of 57. Tobin Rote was actually the quarterback who quarterbacked them to the NFL championship, and Lane went on to Pittsburgh. So, but that's, yeah, when the Lions were last relevant was in the 50s, when they had a chance, when they were playing for a title.
Am I just imagining things, or did Tobin Rote go into the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, like, recently?
Probably not long ago.
Yeah. I don't
former Rice Owl.
Yeah, I don't know why that sounds. Or maybe it was reading. Maybe it was like the San Antonio Sports Hall of Fame. Something. There was a Hall of Fame Tobin Rote went into that.
Yep.
I read a story about within the last few years that he went into a Hall of Fame. You know what, Craig? I've got Hall of Fame stuff that I wanted to discuss in the notebook. By the way, I want to mention this real quick before we go to break, though.
Somebody said, "Hey, Craig, why do you keep saying the words Mexican Elvis in the middle of sentences?" Because that's what he titles his text as.
That's his name.
Mexican Elvis.
That's his name on the text line.
That's his name on the text line. That's why. That's why. So
Stoner.
I wouldn't make that up.
Stoner, CB, golf.
Allstruck Construction. Yeah. 11, what, pooped 11 times in one day.
That's my favorite.
Yeah, it's your favorite.
Beaver Lance Jason. So yeah.
Beaver Lance Jason.
But before we go to break, Craig, I do want to mention, if you want some good hardcore Longhorn football talk, new episode of the Longhorn Blitz podcast is out. It is published. Anywhere you get your podcast, just search Horns 24/7 podcast. Click the subscribe button to get every episode of the Blitz. And I don't know if you caught the Blitz last night, Craig, but I was getting some texts, got some good feedback. People were enjoying the good, meaty kind of football theory discussions myself and Rod Babers and Matt were having on the Blitz last night. So anywhere you get your podcast, whatever podcast platform you use, the Blitz is available right now.
Somebody asking, how do we get our names on the text line? Burn Orange Yeti wants to know.
That would be a Trey Elling question, I believe.
Is it? Yeah, because I started
probably
to say. Yeah. Somebody asked what David Thomas is up to these days. Is he in education?
Either that or real estate. There's something.
Yeah.
There's a job where he's making a very good living.
Mm-hmm. And somebody else had Old Turnpike Stadium in Arlington was a dump, but it had a great future. Yeah. That was that's where my broadcast mentor, Bill Mercer, called games in the 60s. It was built in 1965 up to 71, and then they enlarged it. And you talk about, but your mic is open there, Snoop. You okay there?
Sorry, I was reading the text line laughing.
Okay.
Right. I named that guy Burnt Orange Eddie.
Yeti. Yeti. Yeah.
Eddie. Okay.
Oh, you named him?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you know how to do it?
So Snoop can do it, yes. Ladies and gentlemen.
So people are turning in their names. Yeah, turn them in. Yeah. I'll do it.
Yeah.
Why do I feel like this is going to be like, you know, you remember in the XFL when you could pick whatever you wanted on the back of your jersey?
Yeah, you know, that's
Rod
right.
Smart, he hate, he me. Hate me.
Yeah.
There was a guy that wanted the name. This is in the XFL documentary. This was the XFL. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but it's awesome. You should check it out. But there was a guy for playing for one of the teams that wanted to put Teabagger on the back of his jersey.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, Vince McMahon's just looking down the list, just not thinking any of it. And about the third time somebody scans it over, Vince, I don't think we can have this. Like, what do you mean, pal? So somebody had to explain to Vince
why
Teabagger on the back of the jersey wouldn't fly.
You know, that was Taylor Teagarden's nickname.
What do you, well, yeah. It was
Teabag.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was his nickname there. No, five national championship team. All right. We'll get to more. We'll get to more of your text, and so we have another notebook coming up as well. Here on Light the Tower on the Horn, live, local, and digital on the Horn app and at hornfm.com. It is time once more for the notebook.
Jeff Howe's Longhorn Notebook, brought to you by Cedar Park Overhead Doors. Go to cpdoors.com.
Now, before Jeff launches into the notebook with some really good stuff, I'm going to add one other bit of information. I don't know. Did you have the this was announced yesterday, the 2021 All Big 12 All Academic Team? Did you
see that? I saw that come down. Yeah, just got the release from Texas on that. If you give me a second, Craig, I can run that down. Yeah, you want to just run down the names?
I've got them right here.
Oh, you got them?
Okay. I've got them right here.
Go for it.
First team, and there's several, and this speaks well of baseball in the Big 12 because each school has several guys on the first team, which means if you have a GPA of 3.2 or higher, 3.2 or higher, you make it all academic first team.
Hey, Craig, can we get a timeout real quick? Snoop, let's just go ahead and do interstitial. Let's just make this part of the notebook. So we'll just.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Jeff Howe's Longhorn Notebook, brought to you by Cedar Park Overhead Doors. Go to cpdoors.com.
All right. So there it is, included in the notebook. And these names, these were all Big 12, all academic. First team for the Longhorns: Silas Ardoin, Trey Faltini, Lance Ford, Doug Hodo, Eric Kennedy, Ty Madden, DJ Petrinsky, and Zach Zubia. All first team, all academic. Second team, which is from a 3.0 to a 3.19, just outside that, Cole Quintanilla, Murphy Staley, Tristan Stevens, and Austin Todd. So nice. A healthy representation there for all academic Big 12 guys.
One more baseball note before we get back to football, Craig. Mm-hmm. Postseason honors or season-long honors are coming out now. Collegiate Baseball newspaper has named Mitchell Daly a freshman All-American. Mm-hmm. They announced that this morning. Currently second on the team, hitting .323. Also number two on the team with 60 hits, 14 doubles, 2 home runs, 31 RBI, 32 runs scored to go with 6 stolen bases. Going into the year, Craig, we talked about second base was a question mark, but they just kind of rolled with him there at one point, and he grabbed the bull by the horns and has not relinquished that job and has been really, really good.
I want to say it was probably 2 weeks into the season.
Something like that, yeah.
And just held on to it from there. And to be quite honest about it, in terms of batting average, which Augie Garrido says is the most, I don't know if he said overrated, but
it's deceiving.
Maybe the most deceiving statistic, it was batting average. The reason why I'm saying this is Mitchell's batting average has dropped about 30 points over the last month and a half. But his on-base percentage is still maintained up there, and he's still moving runners around, and he's still playing outstanding in the field. So, yeah. So, congrats to Mitch.
Let's get to some football talk, Craig. You can always find great football discussion at Horns 24/7 and 24/7 Sports. And as a teaser for tomorrow, I want to kind of examine an article my colleague Brad Crawford put out. Teams who could win the college football playoff over the next decade and how Texas fits into that. So we'll get into that.
I started to say, does this include like the prospective and proposed 12-team playoff that we're hearing? What Pete Thamel wrote about it there with Yahoo?
Yeah, this is more so, Brad kind of building, kind of like Chris Hummer does with the with the rolling development rate story. Brad started this prior to the 2019 season, and he's identified programs kind of on the verge of, and it's always something like who's going to be the first to win, you know, in the college football playoff era, win a national championship. Mm-hmm. But this does fall into the line of playoff expansion. We know Alabama, Clemson for the foreseeable future. Notre Dame's going to be in there. They're in there under Brian Kelly right now. But who can join them? Texas in that mix, but tomorrow we'll talk more about kind of just exactly where Texas fits, and we'll start looking into the future. Real quick, Craig, because there's some stuff I want to get to, but it shouldn't take that long. But when we talk about a 12-team playoff, mm-hmm. and in the format that's being discussed, and we could see a decision on this for the next iteration of the college football playoff, we could see this, I think by Monday or Tuesday of next week?
Yep. And it would not take place till 2023.
Right. So what number in your mind, like, were you good at? Because I know Chad was saying yesterday in Shirts and Skins, kind of six has been his number. I know Kevin and Rod on the Triple Option yesterday had a lengthy conversation about this. What kind of, in your mind, is the number you want to see?
I'm the wrong person to ask about because I'm a more is more guy. I wanted a 16-team playoff. Okay. But 12 is good to me. The reason why I wanted 16 is all 11 Division I FBS conferences would be represented if you had that. Plus right. five, you'd have five full at-large bids.
Right.
And you could do it that way. 12, I get it. Give the top four seeds byes. That's okay. And you get certainly all the Power Fives represented, and most of the other ones, the group of fives, would be in there too. But you'd still have to earn your way into it.
Yeah. You know, and I don't want to make this sound like I'm taking an easy way out or not answering the question. I want whatever's going to give us more meaningful intra-conference regular season games. In other words, mm-hmm. I like those big intersectional matchups. I want Texas and Ohio State. Mm-hmm. I like what we're getting this year. I want Ohio State and Oregon. I want these big blockbuster non-conference.
We're going to see Texas, Alabama. Yeah. We're going to see Texas, LSU, or not LSU. We're going to see
Texas and Michigan.
Ohio State. We're going to see, yeah.
Yeah. I want to see more of those games. And if an expanded playoff can give me more of those games, that's what I'm all about. People are like, oh, that's going to water down the regular season. No. Not necessarily. You still have to win your conference. Hell, when we talk about watered down regular season, the NFL's figured out a way to make it work with 17 games and now 18 games. And, mm-hmm. Craig, there's not a Sunday in the National Football League that feels watered down.
No.
So, to me, the watered down the regular season argument, it's just an excuse to preserve the bowl structure as we've known it. But,
and, by the way, they have 14 teams in their playoff, seven in each conference.
Yeah. But the bowl structure is, quite honestly, unless you're a player who gets a trip and a ring for the deal or a coach who gets a raise for going to a bowl game, the bowl games are pretty much meaningless anyway outside of the New Year's Six.
Yeah. You can still keep the bowl structure for those who are not going to get into the playoff. There's still room for it.
If you're part of the, you know, Orlando Convention and Visitors Bureau and you really need the Cheez-It Bowl to be played, then go ahead and play it and give teams a payout. But I want more meaningful college football.
Well, and that's – I think if you're – because if folks say, well, you know, if you have a playoff with 12 teams and teams are not going to schedule tough to avoid losses to miss out, I think it's got to be the opposite.
Yeah.
Create the formula where you have to step up your scheduling. Playing Western Carolina – is not going to help.
Oh, geez. If this helps us, if nothing else,
get rid of cream puff week.
If this helps us get rid of that week in November where everybody in the SEC is playing FCS school,
cream puff week.
Then I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Western Carolinas, no Citadels, no Chattanoogas.
Well, you talk about watering down the regular season. That's the very definition of it, right there.
Yeah,
you got to have a 12th game. Like you said, go play the Citadel.
Yeah.
I want to watch Alabama just roll the Citadel where you've got walk-ons in the game in the third quarter. That doesn't. Doesn't yeah. do anything for me.
Right.
Unless you're an Alabama fan, it shouldn't do anything for you. Otherwise, you probably, you know, went and saw Bucky's cousin and might have a little more of a vested interest in the game or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm all for college football playoff expansion, but we'll talk more about kind of Texas and kind of get the national perspective on how Texas might fit into climbing that mountain, getting over that hump and into the college football playoff with an expanded field if it comes to that. But I want to wrap up, Craig, something mm-hmm. we talked about last segment with our fun fact of the day. 87 days mm-hmm. until Texas and Louisiana, 3 o'clock, excuse me, DKR on Fox, or just turn the Fox volume down. It should be a Tim Brando broadcast, so it gives you mm-hmm. more of an intro, more of a opportunity to turn the volume down anyway. But if you're not doing that and listening to Craig call a game, you're just doing life wrong to begin with. So 87 days, I brought up Kyle Shanahan. He's the head coach that got me on my Tom Landry tangent, which takes me, Craig, to something else that I'm pretty passionate about. Longhorns in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I think there's three guys. You know, Bobby Dillon's getting in this summer. Mm-hmm. And I think there's three guys that have really good arguments. One, I really hope at some point we see in. So here's my three Longhorns that I think should at least be under consideration, and one that I think is going to get in at some point. The one who I think is going to get in at some point, Tommy Knobis, is going to get in at some point. Now, obviously, he won't be here to enjoy the induction, mm-hmm. but when you look at him, he was a great player on some really bad Atlanta Falcons teams, mm-hmm. was a number one overall pick in the draft. You look at the resume Tommy Knobis put together, Craig, that to me is a Hall of Fame resume. And as now we see kind of the proliferation of the veterans committee and guys that are getting in, Tommy Knobis, I hope at some point in my lifetime, is going to get in the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
I hope so.
To me, that should be a no-brainer, but I feel like Tommy Knobis will get in. The two guys that I think warrant strong consideration, one is Steve McMichael. And when you look at Steve McMichael's in the College Football Hall of Fame, mm-hmm. but when you look at his resume, 4-time All-Pro, a member of the 85 Bears, and he was voted one of the 100 greatest Chicago Bears of all time. When you look at that resume and look at that run he had in the late 80s to early 90s, you can make the argument. And again, I think this is going to be, it's going to be one of those veterans committee deals. And you know, given his ALS diagnosis, unfortunately, it'll probably be after Mongo has left this earth. But I feel like Steve McMichael should be getting stronger consideration for the Pro Football Hall of Fame than he's gotten. And the other one, Craig, you can make a really strong argument, and I would love to make the argument, Casey Hampton should be under consideration for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. 5-time Pro Bowler, 2-time Super Bowl champion with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And when you're a defensive lineman, specifically a nose tackle in an odd front, and you can make the Pittsburgh Steelers all-time team, to me, I don't know what else says Hall of Fame worthy resume than that.
If you get in the case of both Steve McMichael and Casey Hampton, you're talking about two of the most storied franchises in National Football League history.
Yes.
The Bears and Steelers. And if you're making their all-time team, that speaks to how good a player you were.
So those are three guys. I feel like Tommy Knobis should get in, deserves to get in, will get in at some point, but I would like to see from the Veterans Committee down the road stronger consideration for both Steve McMichael and Casey Hampton.
Yeah.
And I am biased to Casey Hampton because while I am a journalist now and I'm supposed to stay impartial, I have no qualms mentioning Craig outside of like guys that have their names on the wall at DKR. Casey Hampton is my all-time favorite Longhorn. If you go back and look at some of the numbers he put up at Texas, it's stupid. It's ridiculous. His senior year when he was Big 12 Defensive Player of the Year, at a nose tackle, he had something like 20, 22 tackles for loss. As a nose tackle, and Craig, you called those games, he's getting double and triple teamed every game.
Yep.
And still had over 20, led the team in tackles. How do you lead the team in tackles at a nose tackle position in this modern era of college football? It's just stupid, some of the numbers Casey Hampton put up.
No doubt. There's the notebook. A couple other cleanup, you know, when we were doing about that whole nickname thing. Snoop, are you still assigning nicknames to people? Are they requesting them?
As they come in, yes. Some of the names I don't know if y'all will be able to say, so I'm encouraging you to say
keep
something.
It clean. Like Fishhead Tim is okay, I suppose. Well,
but Fishhead Tim, you're already in the system, so
yeah,
you're good.
And Putz number 13 is in the system, said he got his listener name all the way back during Alex Loeb's midday show here years ago.
Wow.
Guessing he didn't like my text since I ended up with Putz in the nickname. Well, that's a good guess.
But see, Ramon, you want to be T-Bird Sanchez, but you're already in the system as Ramon, so you're Ramon.
Limerick winner 3.3 said, I got my name because I won a couple of Limerick contests a couple of years ago when Chip and Chad had a contest once a week for free golf, and Nick People's nickname was Dirtbag. It was.
should treat this like Reservoir Dogs, like how they had to hand out names. Or, you know, you're Mr. Pink, you're Mr. Blonde.
Absolutely. Captain Rhino said, I laughed every time Craig called him Teabag. Hey, it was his nickname, you know?
It was his nickname.
You know? I'm just saying, you know, that it was. So, anyway, though that was some of those who were doing it. And there's a lot of folks who are behind the expanded college football playoff, and also Stoner tells you might need Ed Warder to pick up the call since Nobis was a Texas guy.
Well, I would think, I don't know. I mean, Terrence Moore, there's some really good pro football writers in Atlanta that could take up the call.
Well, that's a great legalize it. Says, love my name. Okay. So there you are. All right.
Who does this fun?
Robert and Giddings says, instead of Robert and Giddings, let's see. Can I get, let's wait for it to come up, Bob from DB, since I'm from Dime Box. Sure, why not? Yeah, I guess you could. Somebody's like, hey, Snoop, what's my name? Are you actually assigning them?
No, heck no. You have to come up with your own name.
Okay, because somebody said, hey, Snoop, what's my nickname? You know, there's people, everybody's wanting Snoop to assign nicknames. You can't do. Victor wanting to know, why can't they do with RPI in college football similar to what they do in baseball? That kind of speaks to what we're talking about scheduling tougher. Yeah. To do that. So I think it would.
In ESPN, if you look at their FPI stuff, they have a formula that computes strength of record, strength of schedule, all that fun stuff. I don't know how hard the selection committee looks at that stuff, but right. I would imagine it gets mentioned in the room.
Somebody else that loved the 12-team proposal argued that this model will only make the conference championship games all the more compelling and will encourage more marquee non-conference games and scheduling to impress the panel to get one of the at-large spots in the playoff if a team stumbles in the conference schedule. Imagine DKR rocking for a home playoff quarterfinal game in mid-December. Yeah. That could be a lot of fun. So I agree there. Big Crit Fan says, If eight at most, usually only one or two non-Power 5 schools that deserves a shot. So that leaves five conference winners, three at large, who can be non-P5 or deserving two-loss teams.
I'll pull the pin on this grenade.
Yes.
On the CFP expansion discussion.
Yeah.
Do you know what it gives you the window to, Craig? What it gives you, what door it opens? This is a perfect opportunity for Texas and Texas A&M to renew the rivalry on an annual basis.
Look at you pulling the pin.
Because it's going to help you to play the game for your strength of schedule in theory more than it's going to hurt you if you lose that game.
Yeah.
So if that's what it's going to take, you're going to have to incentivize both sides, both financially and in terms of what does this mean in terms of competing for and winning a national championship.
Going back to our arena and stadium conversations, hey, Craig and Jeff, although L.A. Coliseum has lots of great stuff, like Olympic memorabilia, it's honestly a dump.
It is.
I take it he's probably referring to when Texas played USC out there. They've since redone it.
Yeah, and there's still more refurbishments to come on that place.
And somebody asked me if I, quote-unquote, remembered when the Dodgers played there. They did for four seasons, 58 through 61.
Well, you want to get a mind F. Go put that in the Google machine and go look at some of those outfield dimensions.
Well, I can tell you what they were. It was 249 feet down the left field foul line, and they had a 50-foot screen on top of it to try to block home runs, cheap home runs. But the Dodgers had a journeyman outfielder by the name of Wally Moon, who had played with the Cardinals and other, and he used to what were called moonshots, and he could hit it where he could pop fly that home run over the screen. So he did that. The right field foul line was 390 feet. So and so it was cavernous the way it did. And they won a World Series in it.
Yeah.
In their second year, 1959, they have established a record that I can say confidently, Jeff, that will never, ever, ever, ever be broken. Game 5 of the World Series between the Dodgers and White Sox, 92,706 in attendance.
Yes.
There will never be a ballpark or a stadium that will hold that much for a World Series game, ever.
Don't let Jerry Jones hear that. He'll figure out a way to make it work.
Football, different. Football, you can cram that in on some of those.
He'll figure out a way to make it work in his stadium with standing room only and whatnot.
Yeah. Can you do baseball played in that place?
If you tell him he can set an attendance record, he'll figure it out.
Yeah. Good luck, Jer. Well. All right, we'll be back to wrap it up here. Light the Tower on the Horn. So... just about done. Oh, by the way, said they saw a game at the L.A. Coliseum baseball game. Said Wally Moon was in left, Charlie Neal at second, Pee Wee Reese at short, Gil Hodges at first. Yes, late 50s, early 60s, Dodgers did win the 59 World Series there. And you look at some of the weird dimensions, like you said, of that. It's a strange-looking scene, no doubt. See, Google it, the Game 5 1959 World Series, and you'll see the fans all the way around it. And they actually broke that attendance record for an exhibition game against the Yankees honoring Roy Campanella, who had been recently paralyzed at the time. And they had over 93,000 there for that when they had an exhibition game with the Yankees there. And everybody lit a candle, and it was really inspirational and all that.
You're not going to get that kind of a crowd ever for a baseball game.
Ever.
Don't tempt Jerry. He'll figure out a way to make it work.
Well, first of all, he's got to actually get a game in there, okay? So
he'll figure it out.
I don't think
they'll sell 30,000 party passes and claim they put 110,000 in there.
Well, they will, and that's the end of the show. Hey, we'll be back with you tomorrow, coming your way tomorrow morning. Thanks to our man behind the glass, our producer Snoop Daniel, and for Jeff Howe, I'm Craig Way. Stay tuned. Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey up next. We'll visit with you tomorrow at 10 o'clock right here on Light the Tower.